Since the COVID era began, fear-mongering and warmongering about China has been on the rise. Though there has been some truth to some of the points raised, there has also been a lot of disinformation and war propaganda thrown at the public, particularly in the West, both before COVID and since. But consistently, the narrative has been that this is a power struggle of nation state versus nation state. And this narrative, of course, fails to account for the elite influencers and transnational power structures that unite China and the West behind the scenes. And because this critical aspect of the situation is hardly ever discussed, it's not common knowledge at all, and many are completely unaware that the key factions of the powers that be of U.S. empire overlap considerably with the powers that be in China. These related power factions in both countries are part of a larger transnational elite that we've also seen a lot more of in the COVID era, as they've been at the forefront of promoting global governance, the fourth industrial revolution, and the so-called Great Reset. So in order to really understand this transnational effort to enact these agendas globally, we must examine the power structures driving them behind the guise of countries that we are told are antagonists and are to some degree, but also share a lot more than the public has been led to believe. So joining me today to discuss the realities at work here is actually the very person whose work first opened my eyes to them several years ago, James Corbett of The Corbett Report. For those not familiar with James's work, several years ago, he released a documentary called China and the New World Order that I found incredibly revealing. And since then, he's had a lot more to say on the topic in subsequent interviews and in writing. So without further ado, hey, James, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on, Whitney. This is an incredibly important topic that doesn't get enough attention. When it does, I don't think it's explored in the right way. So hopefully we can correct some of that today.
Yeah, I think we both definitely agree on that. So I think a good way to start off is to look at this Financial Times article that came out a few years ago that I think is a good way to sort of broach this subject with, the uninitiated, for lack of a better term. So let me pull up this article quickly here. So this is from the Financial Times. It's called The U.S., China, and Wall Street's New Man in the Middle. Of course, there was a man in the middle before him. This is an article largely about Stephen Schwarzman, but also about a class of individuals that are basically called the New China Whisperers. And if you're not familiar with Stephen Schwarzman and Blackstone Capital, you should be. They own probably close to half of the United States. What BlackRock doesn't own, Blackstone owns. But I highlighted a few excerpts here. So I'll just read from that really briefly and then let you take it from there, James. So it says in his offices, a short walk from, I'll probably butcher the pronunciation. So from the Chinese Communist Party's leadership compound in central Beijing, Vice Premier Liu He maintains a large collection of photos taken with foreign VIPs. He's, you know, Xi Jinping's most trusted economic advisor, blah, blah, blah. But people add that one picture in Mr. Liu's collection is always on display. It shows the vice premier engrossed in conversation with Henry Kissinger. Few statesmen are as revered in Beijing as Mr. Kissinger, who is Richard Nixon's national security advisor and secretary of state, masterminded the U.S. and China's rapprochement at a time when Mr. Xi and Mr. Liu were teenagers trying to survive the Cultural Revolution. Dr. Kissinger is a foreign policy deity in Beijing, says Drew Thompson, a former U.S. Defense Department official. He has always had a sympathetic ear in Beijing, and Chinese leaders have continually sought to use his celebrity and access to influence Washington. Okay, so people that have been sort of in either one of the two echo chambers that we hear a lot about China in media, either on the left or the right, especially on the left, right, which, you know, there tends to be a lot of, xenophilia these days, you know, maybe like, well, we know Henry Kissinger's a war criminal, but whoa, what's he doing there? right. So I think maybe a good place to start is explain, Kissinger's role in the opening up of China, who Kissinger is connected to in terms of this transnational elite and how this sort of developed. If you want to go farther back in time, of course, that's fine. But how that sort of shaped the China of today and this power structure that we'll be exploring in this video.
All right. Well, that's quite the setup. And yes, it is extremely important to note that these connections didn't just spontaneously appear, and they didn't just, China didn't just start rising yesterday. This has been a decades long, half century long now process that has been deliberately put in place to put China in the position that it is in today. And we cannot understand anything about what's going on today unless we understand that. So with a subject this broad, this a scope of inquiry this broad, it is impossible to do anything more than scrape the surface in a conversation like this. So at the risk of making any of my listeners in your audience roll their eyes, because this is about the 8,000th time I've mentioned it, but I will, of course, direct people back to my episode 297 on China and the New World Order. It was the seminal work that I did several years now that got me started into this process of researching this. And sometimes I surprise myself. I went back and re-listened to it for the first time in several years recently, and just it struck me afresh how much information is in that episode. I really did jam-pack it with data. But the long, 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 long story short is that, yes, Nixon is often credited with reestablishing American diplomatic relations with Mao and China. But it was not Nixon who went to China. It was Kissinger in a series of meetings that were preparatory to Nixon's visit in 1971. Kissinger had preceded him the previous year and basically opened up the door. And as everyone admits, it used to be, I haven't checked recently, but it even used to be in Kissinger's Wikipedia profile, Kissinger was always understood to be an emissary of the Rockefeller family. He was discovered by the Rockefellers when he was director of a Council on Foreign Relations study group on nuclear weapons back in the 1950s. And from that time, he was essentially in the employ one way or another of the Rockefeller family, working closely with Nelson and with David. And it was definitely in Rockefeller family interests to open China in a specific way. And that's because Rockefeller family interests in China date back over a century, specifically Rockefeller medical interest in China was there in the early 20th century, and investments have continued. The Rockefeller Foundation brags about its long, rich history with China, which gives you a sense that this didn't just start yesterday. This isn't just some process that happened. And you could, as you say, you could go back much further than Nixon going to China in 1970. You could go back to way back in the early 19-teens and 20s, where you started the establishment of Rockefeller Foundation in China. You had Yale in China, which was a series, Yale Divinity School and other branches of Yale that were operating in China that, for example, employed a certain young man by the name of Mao to become the editor of one of its journals to begin thought reorientation towards what ultimately became the communist revolution there. Yes, Mao was a Yalee. There are other surprising things that come up. In fact, if you go into the history of Blackstone Group, as you brought up there, which is absolutely relevant to what's going on today, as you say, an incredibly important asset manager in the new economic world order. Go back to 2013 when aforesaid Stephen Schwarzman started a scholarship program, an international scholarship program in China, endowing it with $300 million to emulate the Rhodes Scholarship program, which I'm sure your informed listeners will know all about. But that's the type of ties that Blackstone have had with China for a very long time. Blackstone, of course, a spinoff from BlackRock, spun off from BlackRock. It started in BlackRock in 1988 as basically the investment management arm of BlackRock, spun off as its own separate company in 1994. BlackRock, with close ties to AIG, American International Group, which had invested over $1 billion in it back in the 1990s. And AIG was, of course, the American International Group, which started as the Asiatic American Underwriters in Shanghai in 1919 by one Cornelius Vanderstar, who is an incredibly important character in the old economic world order, I suppose. And AIG then went on to become a key operational unit, as it were, of the OSS, the forerunner to the CIA, in World War II, when the OSS began its own insurance unit, which made use of the extensive records that AIG at that time had on various business operations in China. That relationship continued to the point where Cornelius van der Staar's heir, protege, Maurice Hammer and Hank Greenberg, in the 1990s was actually being considered to become director of Central Intelligence. George Tenet ended up getting the spot, but the fact that Greenberg was in the running should tell you something about AIG and its various operations in drug running and other things over the years through Coral Ree. There's an incredibly rich tapestry that does tie into the China nexus through the financial aspects of this that deserves 100 hours of investigation in and of itself.
It's honestly enormous. I sort of stumbled upon this in my own way by doing research for my Epstein book that comes out early next year, because a lot of the money flows there. You know, I'm tracing like the Epstein network back to its origins long before Epstein was really even part of it. And the China ties in terms of financial flows and things like that are really considerable. And honestly, I found them surprising, even though I was familiar with your work, but it just speaks to the interconnectedness, specifically in places like Shanghai and Hong Kong, that these networks have had for a long time. And, it just serves to remind people that Wall Street, it's treated like an entity based in New York, which it is to a big extent, I guess you could say in some sense, right? But it's really a transnational beast. It's a business, and it doesn't really respect national sovereignty or anything like that. You know, these are people not loyal to a particular nation. They're loyal to Wall Street, as a whole. But what you were saying about Blackstone, I actually have some things I wanted to bring up related to that, specifically Schwarzman Scholars, which you touched on. So just give me one moment and I will write. So people may have heard recently about the Evergrande debt. I don't want to swear. cluster bleep. I don't know. debt implosion that Bloomberg, of course, which is funny that it's Bloomberg, but they assure us will be won't spread beyond China and will be a contained event. We'll see if that's actually true. But these are some of the firms that was mentioning, that were mentioned as suffering from Evergrande, which is, I believe, like the largest residential or like building developer in China. And among these, of course, is Blackstone Group. You also have Apollo Global Management of Leon Black fame, and also the Carlyle Group for people that are familiar with them. You know, these are just some of the entities heavily invested in China. And this is just in one company, right? So like a lot of these big Chinese firms have a lot of ties to these Wall Street asset management companies. And as you said earlier, Schwarzman Scholars is here. They all look so nice. Shaping the future of global affairs. It's framed very much as this is the new global economy. China is an integral part of that, as it has a Steve himself says down here, those who will lead the future must understand China today. But what I found particularly telling about it in terms of this transnational group that's so interested and what you alluded to as preparing China to take the helm of the new global economy are the people, working to do this. And obviously, Steve Schwarzman is one of them. But here you have some of the donors, the people he works with to affect that. You have BP. You have Masayoshi Son, who, of course, is of SoftBank fame. But you also have which is some groups that I found interesting, Delta Airlines, but also Glencore, who I believe the owner, main shareholder of that is Nat Rothschild. And then you have Yad Hanadiv, which people may not be familiar with, but that is actually the Rothschild Family Philanthropic Foundation based in Israel. And then you have another foundation there, the Motsepe Foundation, I guess it's pronounced, that was the first foundation on the African continent, to join the Giving Pledge, started by Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett. So don't know if you'd like to continue, sorry.
No, I think that does speak to the interrelated corporate nature of what's gone on. And that is a large section of what I was trying to deal with in my China and the New World Order episode, where I pointed out that the groundwork, the international financial architecture for what became the R&D boom in the 1990s and the massive investment that started flooding into China in the 1990s was laid in a meeting at, of course, David Rockefeller's One Manhattan Plaza, or whatever it was called back in the day when he was the kingpin of Chase back in 1980, where he was meeting with Rong Yiren, who was the director of CITIC, which is China's main state-run, obviously, investment firm. And they were cutting deals to basically get China involved in the international financial banking architecture, which then laid the groundwork for those investments in the 90s that then has since that point allowed these types of incredibly dense networks of association to invest in China in various ways. And you raise the specter of the Carlyle Group, for example, and other firms like this that should be, I hope, well known to people who are researchers in the reality space, not the conspiracy space, the reality space. But it goes to show that this is an international corporate web that has been woven around this and that operates through a number of trusts, groups, scholarships, foundations. Of course, it is always framed in the most positive way possible, but has a dark agenda. And that goes back to what you were saying. We tend to think when we hear Wall Street, we tend to think something to do with bank and finance, and it's in New York. It is an international, essentially, it is a privatized intelligence intelligence arm of the deep state, essentially. It's not beholden to U.S. national interests, per se. It is its own entity. And that's, I think, exemplified in something like Kroll.
Yes.
Private Wall Street.
I was just thinking of them.
Owned by AIG until they sold it to Marsh & McLennan so that the then CEO of Kroll could become the CEO of Marsh & McLennan, Michael Cherkosky, could become the CEO of Marsh & McLennan when it was under investigation by New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, who got his start through Michael Cherkosky. Richard Grove has outlined those kinds of connections that go back to 9/11 and then the crisis leading up to the 2008 bailout. Again, there's such an incredibly dense web here that's woven around these characters, like Maurice Greenberg, who sits on the U.S.-China Business Relations Council and all of these sorts of things.
And Council on Foreign Relations.
That keep going back to that nexus.
Right, absolutely. So I think before we move on more to the present and a lot of what you brought up, though, it is really important to point out a lot of the players that you just brought up, like you were saying, have a lot to do with 9/11 leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. And a lot of these so-called new China whisperers, particularly those involved with what is called the Bloomberg New Economy Forum, which is sort of like a China-focused World Economic Forum competitor. A lot of them have ties specifically to the 2008 financial crisis, and it says so in their bios on the site. We can take a look at that later. But one thing I think that is really important to touch on in this type of conversation. In the beginning, I brought up how, you know, on the left, on the right, there's sort of these two extreme counter narratives that have sort of come even in independent media to sort of dominate the discussion. And at the heart of that, you know, is this claim that China's communist and China's socialist, but really there's a lot of capitalism in China. I think if you look objectively at it, it's quite clear there's lots of billionaires in China for a country that's ostensibly communist. So the origins of that, to an extent, have to do with a group that you have talked about, that you talked about in your documentary, and you've also talked about since. Sometimes they're called the Red Nobility. Sometimes they're called the Eight Immortals and their progeny. Could you explain that a little bit and their significance?
Absolutely. So this is an incredibly important part of this story, and you're exactly right to focus in on this, because the real transition from anything resembling some sort of, you know, communist system towards what we see today operating in China took place in the 70s under Deng Xiaoping, the capitalist rotors who started the transformation of the Chinese economy into what it is today, which is obviously state controlled top to bottom, but is not socialism or communism or anything of the sort. It is absolute. Well, it's technocracy ultimately at its base. But you're right. There's this group of wealthy families that were supporters of Mao back in the days of the revolution, who ended up becoming the basis for the quasi the state run capitalist enterprises that have branched out and have made these people's families enormously wealthy. And we know a great deal about this in a great degree of detail because of an incredible series of reports that was reported by Bloomberg back in the day. I know, please be incredulous, but I invite you to go and actually read the reports. For example, they had a report on heirs of Mao's comrades rise as new capitalist nobility back in 2012, I believe. And that report reads that the family's wealth, these eight families' wealth, traces back to a gamble taken by General Wang and a group of battle-hardened revolutionaries who are revered in China as the Eight Immortals. Backing Deng Xiaoping 2 years after Mao's death in 1976, they wagered that opening China to the outside world would raise living standards while avoiding social upheaval that would threaten the Communist Party's grip on power. So they make the deal with the devil, as it were, to sell out their communist principles for Mullah. But don't worry. The rising tide raises all boats. So yes, we're going to get enormously wealthy first, but everyone else will kind of come afterwards or something along those lines.
It's very Reagan-esque now.
it's an interesting ideology, but it clearly speaks to the mindset. At any rate, whatever the Eight Immortals themselves, so-called, actually thought, their descendants have essentially taken it as the green light to begin partying it up like it's going out of style. So Bloomberg continued on with that reporting. They had this infographic mapping China's red nobility. They did some extensive reporting on it until guess who stepped in and quashed that investigation? Well, I mean, it was an entire team of editors and publishers and everyone, but obviously Michael Bloomberg himself. A great degree of his 50 billion plus estimated net worth comes from the selling of Bloomberg terminals, which is access to essentially market data and what have you, that at that time, specifically in the early 20-teens, Bloomberg was very much set on China as a major target for their customer base, essentially. So they were getting tapped on the shoulder by the Chinese Communist Party that was not liking this particular reporting. One of the reporters even had to move to Hong Kong because he was getting death threats, etc. So they came in and squashed that. And that's even admitted. I mean, there's, again, mainstream news actually reporting news. But you can read about that in a fascinating piece from, I know you won't believe it, NPR, of all places. Bloomberg News killed investigation, fired reporter, then sought to silence his wife, that goes through the story and how it was quashed, etc. But it goes right to the heart of this issue that we're dealing with, these eight immortals families and how they have become this incredibly rich and powerful class that you can't even talk about in China. In a remarkably similar way to the way that the real upper class aristocracy functions in the deep state in the US and everywhere else. It's almost like it's an interconnected system that functions pretty much the same in every country in the world, despite whatever labels we attach to their governments.
Right. Good point. So I want to go back a little bit to the Rockefellers. So, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert on the Rockefellers, but I am familiar with some of the things they sought to influence and change, particularly in American society. So, for example, in education, you know, there was a desire by them to shape education to prepare a new generation of factory workers and to not necessarily create the best education system in the U.S. from the perspective of furthering academia and learning and what have you, but creating good workers. Right. And it seems like a lot of their influence on China, since they, you know, China opened up and the Rockefellers became even more involved than they were before, has really allowed them to have a much even larger playground for those types of ideas, not just in education, but maybe, in other settings as well. And of course, for people that have been reading Unlimited Hangout recently, John Klesak's been doing some work on ed tech specifically, and how a lot of that is being though he's been focusing on it within the U.S., it's quite clear that China's education system right now, for example, you know, that a lot of kids have to wear, little kids have to wear like headsets and, you know, it's data mining kids for artificial intelligence and all of this stuff. And this seems to be something that's sort of been guided by, I guess you could say Silicon Valley, but also, you know, American oligarchs going back, you know, back to the Rockefellers, really, and some other ones as well. Do you have any thoughts on that? I don't.
Right. Well, let me underline and stress once again, the Rockefeller Foundation has been intimately involved in China since at least 1914 with the development of the China Medical Board. And specifically, their first forays there were about Chinese medical culture, medical colleges, creating a medical education system that would teach the Chinese on Western allopathic medicine, trying to export Rockefeller medicine to China, essentially. And having been largely successful in doing so, setting up the Peking Union Medical College and other such things in 1917. But of course, it greatly expanded from there and has continued and persisted. And people might wonder why, particularly what's the connection. And part of that is revealed. I often go back to Rockefeller's ode to Mao on his death that was published in the New York Times in 1973 from a China traveler, where he called the social experiment under Mao, one of the most important and successful in history. But he also wrote that the Chinese, for their part, are faced with altering a primarily inward focus that they have pursued for a quarter century under their current leadership. We, for our part, are faced with the realization that we have largely ignored a country with 1/4 of the world's population. When one considers the profound differences in our cultural heritage and our social and economic systems, this is certain to be a long task, with much accommodation necessary on both sides. And I think this goes back to the driving quest of the Rockefeller family in particular, but the Rothschilds and all of the other major players that we've talked about so far, which is the standardization, homogenization. Globalization is not just some sort of term. It's not just a name. It truly means the creation of a global financial architecture, which will be the basis for a form of global governance, however that ends up looking. And I don't think that necessarily looks like a one world government at any time in the near future. In fact, it may be more beneficial for groups like this to create a system whereby you have a tripartite world structure or something along those lines, where there appear to be rivalries at various levels of the system, but there's a deeper reality underneath. And that's something that I've tried to stress in my work over the last several years, trying to expand this conversation between, as you identify quite rightly, the Sinophiles and the Sinophobes that are increasingly dominating this conversation. China is the great evil. They are responsible for everything, versus China is wonderful and puppy dogs and rainbows, and they're investing all around the world, and isn't everything happy? There isn't a level of 3D chess taking place here, and I know post-Trump, that is a tainted phrase to use, but it's one that I use advisedly because I was using it before Trump. I mentioned it in China and the New World Order. I expanded on that in a recent editorial that I'll direct your listeners' attention to because I think it's important, how to play 3D chess, where that's my best articulation of this idea that there really are multiple levels of what's going on here. And there is, of course, there is a nation state system where nation states are being pitted against each other. But that is not the full story. And the way I see it, you have the collaborationists that are working at the deeper level, the mm-hmm. Rockefellers, the Kissingers, the Rothschilds, the Paulsons, other people like this, Bloomberg and others, who are part of this international financial architecture that's being woven with China as a key element in it. You also have the Cold Warriors, who I think genuinely believe what they're saying. The CIA director, William Burns, you have U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, David Goldfein, you have Christopher Wray, former FBI director, and others who come out with these warnings, China is the biggest threat. And there is a large extent to which these people might actually believe that. But I think they are being used by the collaborationists in the greater game, which is for control of the global financial architecture that's being woven. Yes, China will be dealt a hand at this poker table, but who's going to get the winning hand? And I think that's the sort of level at which the real conflict is taking place.
I would actually add another class to that as well, that's exemplified by Eric Schmidt, the former head of Google, who publicly claims to oppose China and, oh, they're a national security threat because of how far they've advanced in AI. But really, if you look at his actions, he's a total collaborationist. And totally
That's kind of my point. The collaborationists use the Cold Warriors and use their narrative to forward their own agenda.
Right. Yeah. But I think there's some that, like you said, are Cold Warriors and they totally believe China is a threat. And then there are some who posture that way because it sounds nicer than, you know, the alternative for their particular agendas to say so, but are in reality collaborationists and whatnot. But I think the power structure to which the world is attempting to be led right now is this collaborationist one that you mentioned, of sort of this power sharing agreement, maybe we can call it, between the U.S. and China, and this Bloomberg New Economy Forum seeks to promote that. And that's actually hosted by Mike Bloomberg, chaired by Henry Paulson, and the head of it is Henry Kissinger. So you have them like all there together. And basically, you know, as Kissinger phrases it, it's either we collaborate like this and we make this globalist power sharing agreement with China or nuclear war and we'll all die. So you decide what you want, little people, which obviously isn't a fair choice. But it's, of course, you know, Henry Kissinger, despite his litany of crimes and scumminess, is still very well respected in elite foreign policy circles in the U.S. and elsewhere, and also within China. So this is definitely, you know, there's an effort here to lead the U.S. that way. One particular piece of focus in that particular agenda has to do with tech and AI. Eric Schmidt being part of the National Security Commission on AI, chairing that with a former Department of Defense guy under Obama. And essentially, you know, they publicly say we have to counter China by doing this, that, and this. But if you read their documents, as I talked about in a report last year, they're essentially collaborationists as well, and quote Kissinger in their documents and all of that. And they use the fear mongering to say, in order to beat China, we have to become China, and then we must collaborate and power share with them on the road to global governance. So
let me throw in a reference that I was just looking at that's absolutely right along these lines. It was by David Ignatius in the Washington Post last year. Yes, David Ignatius, even other lamestream reporters call him the mainstream apologist for the CIA. So gives you a sense of where he comes from. But he had a post up, an opinion post, decoupling the U.S. from China would backfire, where he's quoting various experts like Jason Matheny, a former director of IARPA, who contributed to a report that was issued for the Working Group on Science and Technology in U.S.-China Relations, sponsored by the University of California, San Diego, and the Asia Society, all groups that deserve further scrutiny, that was saying that China is closing the gap in technology when it comes to this AI type of stuff, but the U.S. can widen its lead if it adopts the right policies, and it's exactly framing it in that way. We don't want to break with China because that could be disastrous. We want to, you know, work with them, and we don't worry, we'll come out on top, guys, as long as we keep collaborating.
Yeah, just to add it, because you brought up and we're approaching 20 years of anthrax as well, Jason Matheny worked pretty closely with the Dark Winter co-authors Tara O'Toole and Thomas Inglesby for a time. So not only is he, you know, intelligence community and now national security on AI, he's also has his hand in that pie, as is often the case with the people we really should be paying attention to in U.S. government who never really get any coverage.
Yep. I didn't even know that connection, but it doesn't surprise me in the least.
There's some connections that you wish weren't there, but, you know, whatever. So anyway, so basically what we have there with the AI thing, in one sense, is used sort of by these transnational tech companies, in a sense, for what is essentially tech transfer between the U.S. and China. And you've written about another type of transfer that's gone on, particularly the military tech transfer, between the U.S. and China. Of course, this has been framed by the media when it's been reported on as intellectual property theft by China. But you contend, and this, of course, would fit in the context of everything else we've discussed thus far, that this is more of a planned transfer and has some parallels with the underreported history of what took place during the previous Cold War with the Soviet Union. So would you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Gladly, yes. It's such an important part, an aspect of this story. And you're right. I did write a report on China's suspiciously American arsenal, where not only writing about, but actually showing examples of essentially the exact same U.S. military systems are popping up in China. And, you know, I mean, you can look at them side by side. They're virtually identical, right down to even the design of the exterior of these various MQ-8 Fire Scout unmanned Hello from the Chinese, from Northrop Grumman versus the Sunward SVU-200 Flying Tiger from the CCP. There's no end of examples of that type of technology transfer that absolutely is going on. It is being largely facilitated by the convenient middleman cutout that has been used in these operations in the past, like with Iran, Israel, of course. It goes through Israel, which has been well reported on. Israel's second largest trading partner is China. In fact, jumping from over 200 times between 1992 and 2017, now trade volume is $11 billion as of 2017. But this goes way back. It's been reported over and over again from military.com in 2013. Report, Israel passes U.S. military technology to China. 2004, U.S. anger at Israel weapons sale from our good friends at the BBC. Also Asia Times, U.S. up in arms over Sino-Israel ties. 1996, U.S. military technology sold by Israel to China upsets Asian power balance. Talking about Israel's Lavi fighter bomber was designed to be one of the deadliest weapons in the air. However, it now has been revealed that after the Israel discontinued the largely U.S. funded project, it sold China the plans for the Lavi and the associated secret U.S. technology. CIA officials specializing in aviation technology were stunned at the 3D images generated by the computers. China's newest fighter jet was, in fact, a copy of the Israeli Lavi, which itself was modeled upon the U.S. F-16 Fighting Falcon multi-role aircraft. And I have other examples that are just almost funny, I suppose. For example, you can look at, there's actual video footage that's been released by the Chinese military of some of their state-of-the-art cutting-edge drones and naval vessels and other things that show some of the screens that are operating on these various technologies that have English as their default language. And even yellow journalist Popular Mechanics had to put it that it begs the question whether or not software and other technology originally from the United States and other Western countries is flying on Chinese military aircraft. Yeah, you don't say. Yeah, it's absolutely going on. The only part of this story that is in any way sort of under the table, as I say, it's even being reported in military.com, Israel is passing U.S. military technology to China. Yeah, of course, it's happening out in the open. So why is it a shock every time it's revealed? It's because this is part of the long-term game plan. And you cannot understand that long-term game plan or how it functions without looking at the history of how this has functioned in the past. And in China and the New World Order, I cited the work of Anthony Sutton, specifically his scholarly research into this in the early 1970s, before he got essentially kicked out of academia for doing research that even Zbigniew Brzezinski cited and name-checked and said, you know, this is really good scholarly research on military technology transfers to the Soviet Union that were happening at the height of the Cold War. And all of this American military technology and various Ford technology and other such things ends up on all of these Soviet weapon systems and military implements that then get used against American soldiers in Korea and other, I mean, things like this that happen over and over that Sutton cited and tracked the various payments and how the technology transfers worked. It's the exact same thing. And I think for the exact same reason, it is the creation of the boogeyman in order to justify the, oh my God, there's a boogeyman. Well, now we have to go crazy fighting the boogeyman. And that's exactly what's happening. I see it even here in Japan, where now the Japanese government is requesting the largest ever military budget in its history on the back of course, the China threat, because China is the growing military presence. There's a certain logic to it. You can't argue. Yes, they are a growing military presence. But why? Why? How have they leapfrogged every other nation to become this great competitor with America for military predominance? Well, there's several reasons, all of which tend to point back to the same group of interconnected financial and military planners in the West.
What you touched on with Israel, I think, is really important, because pulling on that thread of the Israel tech transfer role completely demolishes a lot of the China hawk talk on the right, because a lot of those people at the same time very aggressively support U.S. military aid to Israel and military transfer to Israel, but are also unwilling to point out that these transfers and these connections between Israel and China that are going on, and the fact that that is pretty much never talked about on the right, I think illustrates the some of the points we're exploring here, that there are deeper and deeper power structures at work. And that's really where the power here lies, essentially. And people are intentionally being kept really at a superficial level in order to avoid really understanding the deeper stuff at work here. So I guess from that point, it makes sense to maybe explore a little bit some of this transnational elite, what goals they have when it comes to China. Why do they want the rise of China? Why have China emerge as this military superpower with their help, and things like that? What role is China set to have in the new global economy? Why does it need to happen this way, et cetera?
Is that a question?
I should probably phrase it. more as a question, but yeah, I think
let's put it this way. I will go back to the clip that I played in China and the New World Order of an interviewer asking Anthony Sutton about this. Okay, you've laid out all this information about how the Soviet Union was built up by Western financial interests. Like, why? What are they doing? And so the interviewer says, just tell us all over again, why? And Anthony Sutton says, why? You won't find it in the textbooks. Why is to bring about, I suspect, a plan to control world society in which you and I won't find the freedoms to believe and think and do as we believe, which is it in a nutshell? I mean, it isn't extremely difficult to wrap your head around this unless you have been indoctrinated your entire life, like we all have, to believe in the nation state game that is being played and believe that that is the full totality of what is happening. No, there is a class that truly considers themselves to be above us. That is the foundation of the eugenics ideology that you and I have talked about. And they genuinely believe that they have the right to control the globe, essentially. And the way to do that is to construct a system of thesis and antithesis that leads to a preordained synthesis. That was what the West versus the Soviet Union in the Cold War was about, was to merge those systems together closer and closer. And that is what the role China is going to take in the 21st century. And I think that's evident. That's obvious to see. And we can put that back to Rockefeller's words in From a China Traveler, calling Mao's social experiment one of the most important and successful in human history. What experiment exactly? Authoritarian control over a quarter of the world's population, as it was at the time. That's a pretty important aspect of this. And we see that taking place. I talked about it earlier. If we had to name the operating governance of China, it isn't communist, of course. It is technocratic. They are bringing in the perfect system of technocratic control over a billion plus people in ways that are, I would like to say, scarcely imaginable. But of course, now we all see it being implemented in our home countries, wherever you are listening to me. The facial recognition systems tied into the national police databases that in real time can track anyone in the country and what they're doing, and have incredible control over everything that's being said. That is the system that is lusted after by the very people who are now building China up to be the boogeyman that then They're getting ahead of us in AI and these other things. We're going to have to be a little bit more like them in order to beat them at this game. And that's why I've noted it time and time again, but I want people to consciously note it when they see it, the type of propaganda we see, specifically from the erstwhile supposedly Sinophobic media, which points to China as, oh, look at these horrible things that they're doing to their populations. But there's always a note of dot, dot, dot. But wouldn't it be nice if we could do that? And we've especially seen that over the past 18 months because China handled the scandemic so beautifully and they did so well because they can do anything they want to their population at any time. And look, they had the QR codes operating in weeks. We've taken all this time and we're just starting to talk about vaccine. Oh, come on. We can move this forward, right?
Yeah, they like to add this caveat. Well, we could have tried those same surveillance, blah, 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 blah policies here, but we have democratic values. That makes us different. And so we'll do it better than them because of our values and all this stuff, which, man, if you're watching this and believe that, you may have meant to have tuned in to the Washington Post podcast or something like that. Yeah. You are likely in the wrong place, unfortunately. So I guess there's a couple different places that we could go to now. But before we move on, in terms of potential goals of why build up China, I think there's also, why make China such the economic, make it the economic powerhouse it is. We have a reality where most countries in the world are dependent on some degree to goods produced in China. And if you have that level of economic dependency, that gives China a lot of leverage. Maybe it hasn't happened yet, but, with the climate change economy makeover that's coming, China could demand that, countries that buy their exports on which they have become dependent must do this, that, and this, things like that. When you're in that type of situation of dependency, to think that this type of elite that also has its hand in the pies of the levers of Chinese economic power wouldn't use that at their disposal, I think maybe a wee bit naive, but it remains to be seen. According to Klaus Schwab's predictions in January of this year, we'll be transitioning out of COVID and into climate change by the end of this year. And he seems pretty on point. thus far, it definitely seems to be moving in that direction, and the role China has to play in that and new green finance and all of that, I think, will be quite telling as we move on. One thing I do want to bring up, and I may screen share for this just to show some examples, is sort of this, I guess you could call it, we've already talked about it a couple times, these two extreme narratives that are particularly common these days in independent media, about, these extreme views of on China that lose a lot of the nuance and a lot of the things we've been talking about or ignore them completely. How we can, I want to get some of your thoughts on maybe how we can combat some of these extreme narratives. So I'll just show a couple examples for people that may be interested in what exactly I am talking about. So I don't mean to dunk on my former employer. They did have a Mint Press News. They did have a quite lengthy editor's note disclaimer at the beginning. I'll leave it at that. But essentially, there are some people, particularly this particular author writing op-eds there, who, if you read down, essentially goes on to try and frame people who oppose gain of function research as Orientalist, racist, and ignorant, among other things. He spends a lot of time dunking on Sam Husseini, who I personally think has done really great work. And in a more recent piece, the same author goes into some discussion. I don't know if I highlighted it here or not, but I mean, it's a little absurd in the sense that it claims that gain of function, if you oppose gain of function research, You Are Orientalist and Racist. This is also found in another piece on this particular website as well, essentially framing it as Orientalism. And, you know, I honestly doubt that these same individuals would make that particular case if we were talking about Fort Detrick, for example. It seems to be, you know, a defense of a particular class of research only because it's taking place in China. But of course, what these people, particularly the individual trying to dunk on Sam Husseini, they fail completely to mention that Sam Husseini's most important, well, arguably one of his most important articles on gain of function the last year was about the Pentagon funding of Eco Health Alliance and Pentagon ties to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which again speaks to the sort of transnational issue here, and it's, you know, being obfuscated because it doesn't fit in the particular narrative of this individual. But this, you know, is obviously a counter narrative that developed to, sorry, just give me one second, to things like this, like the Epoch Times, which of course calls COVID-19 the CCP virus. Looks like I got paywalled by these guys, but, you know, Breitbart similarly talking about CCP control over the Wuhan lab. It took them quite a long time to acknowledge the Pentagon ties, and even then it was kind of a footnote, and they didn't properly cite Sam, you know, but I don't know. It seems like one sort of a reaction to the other and one sort of a reaction to the Cold War mentality coming back for, you know, the nationalist perspective of, oh, first it was, you know, during the Cold War, Russia's bad. Now it's China bad and whatnot. So any thoughts on this and how we can combat these?
Yeah, you bring out the important point here, which is that, yeah, the excluded part of this conversation, as always, is the operative part, in the exact same way as the military technology and other technology transfers to China. Wow, they're so powerful all of a sudden. How did that happen? Report after report after report after report of this technology being transferred to China. Oh, wow, shocking. I can't believe gambling is going on in this establishment in the exact same way. To look at Wuhan Institute of Virology as if it was some self-contained thing that the Chinese government set up on its own and was completely doing it all by itself is just such, it's not just nonsense. It's deliberate misrepresentation. There's no way that that could not be misrepresentation. Now, to be as generous as I possibly can with the people calling anything about WIV, looking at that as is Orientalism, and I understand the misgiving about the narrative that clearly is underway right now. It is clearly mm-hmm. being weaponized by people with shady interests and agendas to call this the CCP virus and to blame everything on Wuhan and to say it all originated there. And that's what's the evil here is the Chinese government, because clearly that is being weaponized in the narrative to gin up, at the very least, the Cold War. The Cold Warriors will latch onto as part of their agenda. So I understand the misgivings about that, but it is the wrong take to say, oh, it's racist to talk about gain of function research. No, the correct take is to fill in all of the missing blanks exactly as you did. When the U.S. government outlawed the gain of function research, they outsourced it through the Eco Health Alliance and Peter Daszak, who then started funding what was going on in Wuhan and publishing those types of papers. And Peter Daszak, of course, is the one that comes out saying it's crazy conspiracy theory to talk about lab leak and gain of function. So whether these people who are writing these articles know it or not, they are defending those people and their research. What type of research? Well, of course, let's look at someone like Charles Lieber, who, of course, gets arrested for being part of the Thousand Talents program while he's double dipping from the U.S. side for his research, which he was, of course, as you know, co-researching with Robert Langer, mm-hmm. co-founder of Moderna, looking at various ways that they can monitor people's heart by bioimplants from far away, literally co-writing papers with each other on things like this. None of that will be looked into by any of these players, the Sinophobes or the Sinophiles, because that just completely disrupts the narrative and shows, once again, there's a much deeper layer at which this is going on. And it points in the same direction of international interests that are collaborating on things that are close and dear to the heart of the elitists everywhere, which goes back to things like the transhuman agenda.
Right, great point. So I think we're definitely in agreement there. Though I just have to say, just so it's clear, I don't care if this particular author thinks gain of function is fine when it happens at Wuhan, in Wuhan or whatever. He claims that there is a real line between biodefense and biowarfare. We are coming up 20 years on the anthrax attacks. Please, if you're watching this, get familiar with the fact that when it comes to U.S. military connected entities, including the Wuhan lab, there is really no line, and they abuse it regularly. And to say that there's good gain of function research means that you're not properly, in my opinion, accounting for the risks. Last year, I wrote about a gain of function experiment that was approved at the University of Pittsburgh to combine SARS-CoV-2 with anthrax, supposedly for the purpose of creating a COVID vaccine when there's already like, I think like 190 vaccine candidates around the world, not counting those that have been approved or whatever. Do we really need to combine coronavirus with anthrax? What if that escapes? Is that a good idea? I think most sane people would say no. I think what's happened here, it unfortunately, is a case of someone getting triggered by some sort of, you know, reactionary, you know, narratives. It's unfortunate. So anyway, to move into probably our last little part of this discussion today, unless there's anything after you'd like to add. Of course, this boils down to, will there be a war between the U.S. and China? Of course, you know, there have been these same hidden hands of Wall Street and international power structures at work before previous world wars, which were hot wars, of course. And then they were also there during the Cold War. How will this particular conflict that's being engineered between the U.S. and China go? Of course, I'm sure people are wondering your thoughts on that. So we might as well conclude with the potential doom and gloom. I'll throw it to you.
This is one of the most important questions, isn't it? Is it all smoke and mirrors? Is it all for show? It's all Cold War 2.0. It will be just like the Soviet Union. They'll use it as the boogeyman for as long as they can, ride that for their, you know, to line their pockets, and then it'll go away in the end. Well, it could. It could eventuate into hot war, and I leave that option on the table. I'm not going to bow out by saying, well, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't tell, obviously. But I think it's not just that I can't tell. It's that it isn't determined yet. I think whatever will be most efficient for these elitists to get their way in their unfolding plan will be what they go with. So I don't think it's necessarily set in stone or determined yet exactly how all of this is going to play out. But the idea of hot war is one that is clearly up the sleeve and could take place. And I've made this point before. I think I've articulated it most clearly in a Questions for Corbett I did called How Will World War III Be Fought? Where I answered that question, what do you think World War III would look like? And I talk about the fact that World War I was, from our vantage point today, it is difficult to understand how utterly fracturing of people's psyche that war was, because it completely obliterated previous notions of what warfare was, how it was engaged, what kind of effects it had on the civilian population, etc. It completely changed the paradigm of war itself. And World War II, again, was another fracture point that completely changed how warfare was experienced and what it looked like and what it was capable of, obviously ending with the atomic bombings. And so World War III, I cannot possibly say what a hot war at this point would look like, primarily because we do not know all of the technology that is operable at this point. Of course, every side has layers and layers and layers of secrecy behind which they hide their latest instruments. Don't worry, guys, the SR-71 is clearly the highest altitude plane we have in function and the fastest. There, yeah, it's 50-year-old technology. Yeah, you really think so? No, of course not. It's hidden behind secrecy, so we cannot know precisely what that will look like. But it will, again, be paradigm-changing, fracturing of the psyche, and probably, unfortunately, an order of magnitude more in terms of destruction and death than it would have been in World War II. So it is an option on the table. But the point that I end up stressing at the latter half of that Questions for Corbett that I referenced, that I hope people will watch if they're interested, I stress that World War III is already engaged. The operative, the real World War III, is the war against us. And I mean all of us that are not in this power pyramid, that are not collaborationists in the deep state working on this international level, just the average folks. We are the target. We are victims, whether we know it or not, of a war that is being waged against us by our own governments, whatever that means. Again, the nation state system that we think is operative isn't really the operative one, but we are the targets of this elitist class, and it is already happening. Information warfare is the most obvious form of that, but all sorts of other warfare, including, of course, the genetic engineering of the crops and other such things, that the deployment of 5G and all of these other ways that various things that are being sold to us as products, even that we will then consume, are in fact being weaponized against us. And let's put it this way, could be used in case any bad person ever got into power, could be used against us at a moment to kill or enslave many, many, many people. That is actually the fight that we are in. So we tend to think of World War, of course, in terms of the big geopolitical nation state conflicts. But again, I don't think that's the level at which it's actually operating.
All right. Yeah. You brought up a lot of really good points. I think the info warfare thing is really key. I mean, obviously, that's the battlefield on which you and I fight. Right. And so that's why I think it's so important to have a discussion like this and counter the really extreme narratives that obviously play into the hands of people that want to drive us to that point. I also want to underscore, too, that people should keep in mind, particularly on the right, that, as you pointed out, this is a war of the elite against us. And that includes also the people of China, the general public of China are also being targeted with a lot of these same techniques. And some of it is a lot more advanced over there. But we need to keep in mind that it's the little people of the world, all of us, against this particular behemoth power structure. And in terms of probability of war, I kind of want to take it back to the I guess you could call it the Kissinger threat. I don't really know what else to call it. And sorry to laugh. It's just it's very awful, you know, what and nightmarish what it says. But, you know, when like this 95-year-old blob is like issuing these threats to the world, I mean, it's comical in a sense. But essentially, I think what that Kissinger threat boils down to is, well, you can either collaborate and the little people can agree to go into this world we're creating for them, or there will be resistance and there will be nuclear war and you'll all be blown to smithereens. I mean, that's the threat. And I think, honestly, the point we're at is to call their bluff, really, because, I mean, I don't think they necessarily want to have to go underground into these elite bomb shelters for too long, as would be the case if it really was sort of like a nuclear war scenario. But that seems to sort of be the threat. Either there'll be this awful war, hot war with the U.S. and China, or the U.S. and China can work together in this globalist power structure. I don't know if that's necessarily a threat being leveled at the little people or people that they need to collaborate within the governments of the U.S., in China, quite possibly it's just the latter. but it remains to be seen. Of course, there's a special place in hell for Kissinger. That's why you haven't been able to see it, people watching. But my Hell is Patient Henry Kissinger t-shirt seemed appropriate for today, because he is definitely, you know, done plenty. And hopefully he'll be next. we'll see. Anyway, is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here that we haven't covered yet?
There's a million things that should be covered. And one thing that I'll put out there for your audience as sort of a research project for anyone who's interested in researching further in this, I think there deserves to be deep dives on all of these different types of institutions that are coming up in our conversation, talking about the Working Group on Science and Technology in U.S.-China relations, talking about the Asia Society, talking about the Bloomberg New Economy Forum, and all of these different pieces of the puzzle, the Bergruen Institute, the Bergruen China Center. an interesting player that keeps coming up. So people who are interested could research that further. But let me just summarize then with what I take to be the takeaway of our conversation, which is the Sinophiles and the Sinophobes are both wrong because they are operating on that level at which the nation state system is the operative paradigm, but it is not. So yes, the Chinese government is bad and they are doing horrible things to their people. Absolutely, 100%. But opposing that is not, oh, okay, well then the US government or someone should go in and rain bombs down on those people in order to liberate them from their government. No, there is a much deeper level at which this is taking place. And we are all victims of that same war that's going on. And it is taking place at a different level that's being funded by people like the Kissingers. I mean, Kissinger's just in sort of one player in a much bigger agenda.
That's right,
but that gives you a sense of where this is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, another point you brought up earlier, too, is that this war is happening, this hybrid war against the people, right, is happening right now. And so we can't afford to continue to exist in world or to have worldviews where we're not really recognizing the real power structures driving this. It's time to move past this superficial level of nation state stuff. It's really imperative that we move beyond that in order to see the ruse here and where we're being led, what the goals are and what the end game is, essentially. And if we stay at this nation state level, And people, as many people as there are now, trapped in these counter narratives on both the left and the right, I think it's way past time to try and push people nicely, if you can, out of it, because we really need people to start seeing the bigger picture here, because we really are in this hybrid war that's trying to force global governance, among other things, and all the trappings of that and what that entails. On people in various ways. Of course, COVID-19 was just really the catalyst for this particular new phase of war. They're moving it into climate change and other sorts of things that will be thrown at us now. And the more people resist, the more stuff they will use, hoping that something eventually sticks. That seems to be where this is going. Also, as you mentioned, this is really a topic that is very hard to cover in like an hour long video. It could probably be multiple hours. And like you said, I would really encourage people to do deep dives into these organizations because I certainly haven't seen them. And, you know, I think people like you and I have a lot of stuff of our own projects that we're doing, trying to cover things. It's already a lot for, you know, what I'm trying to cover for one person. I imagine for you, it's the same. I know that there are people watching who may be interested in doing this. And if you are, maybe reach out. And you know, if it's good, you know, you could probably, if Unlimited Hangout won't publish it, maybe I can help you find someone who will, if it's, you know, up to standard. We really need all hands on deck at this point, and trying to get this information covered and out, especially in the censorship environment in which we are living. It's quite likely that will get worse before it gets better. So James, for people that are more interested in your existing work on this topic, where can they find that information?
CorbettReport.com is the one-stop shop to find all of my information. And if there's anything that I've mentioned today, when I mirror this up on my site, of course, I'll put the links to everything I've mentioned, but it should be easily searchable on my site anyway. I've tried to make my site as valuable a resource for researchers as possible. So I always try to link up the documents and things that I'm talking about. And hopefully people will be able to make use of that and start, as I say, with episode 297, China and the New World Order, and start to branch out from there. And there's a lot of resources on this topic.
Great. Well, if you're watching and you enjoyed this video, I would really encourage you to support James's work because he's really the one that a couple years ago when he put out China and the New World Order really brought this to my attention. And I was just amazed. I'd never heard this stuff before. And a lot of James's work is like that, if you're not familiar, very eye-opening. And for years has been covering stuff a lot of other people have either missed or declined to cover for whatever reason. So I would definitely encourage people watching to go to CorbettReport.com, consider becoming a subscriber. And for those watching right now, or the first to watch this video, will of course be subscribers to Unlimited Hangout. and greatly appreciate you. Thanks a lot for that. But of course, this is going to be public just a few days after, because I never paywall for very long. But, you know, and I got, just like you, James, got the platform from Patreon. So we all have to, you know, do what we can to keep doing this work. So once this is public, I would really encourage you to share this far and wide so that we can start fighting against this counter narratives. And it really takes all of us. You know, there are people that I guess you could say are more established in this field that have maybe bigger platforms, but really everything anyone can do is needed at this point. So thanks a lot for watching. Thanks a lot for sharing. And thanks a lot for those that support our work.